Twin gouts of superheated green hellfire tearing down the tight hab corridors of life. We are the pure and searing Promethean belch of justice. 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio. Coming to you live tonight from the back room of Bulge's Sump Rack City.
Gabo, it looks like it's shaping up to be another beautiful fourth shift across all the Underhive. And only 54 dead in last night's riots. The glass eaters just can't seem to get enough glass. Once again spreading their flavor of arson across the Frostar Cab districts. At least their bullshit hasn't stirred up the four-armed emperors.
Basking in the soothing and loving glow of blue plasma, I am your host, Goblin King. Thundering down the catwalks of life, at least since Beast took away his map and doesn't let him navigate anymore, it's Marky.
Oh, low.
Can't navigate for shit anyway.
Our very
you
own...
Me.
Oh my God.
Give me a grid. Give me GPS.
Our very own doubly razor-fisted polar bear of the Frost Hollow himself, it's Chuckerfly.
Hello, welcome everyone. I'm back from my sabbatical of being accused of, and I did it, powdering my face in white warp dust.
Green warp dust, sir. Green warp dust.
Well, what I found was white.
Is that more pure or less pure? I don't know.
I don't know.
And the two-gunned cowboy, don't worry, he probably brought several extra duffel bags full of guns just in case. It's Beast.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome to episode 87, Horus Heresy Part 3, Endgame on Istvan 3. These opening battles of the Horus Heresy are pretty insane. I want to say parts of the Istvan 3 atrocity and the massacre on Istvan 5 are spread through like the first five books. Kind of don't necessarily want to beat a dead horse, but this is a lot of dense and crazy lore that we're getting into that shapes all of the traitor legions and all of the loyalist legions as they are in the 41st millennia, as well as introducing some of the characters that pop up again and again, either historically in the reason that certain things are done, or currently in the case of some of the traitor legionaries we'll talk about, like Abaddon and Lucius and a couple of others who they're just still around fucking shit up.
I mean, I don't really know shit about five.
Marky's learning.
I knew a little bit about three, but
you're gonna learn more about three today.
I don't know shit about a lot of things, so my input would be like, man, that's crazy.
they got space marines fight.
That's a booty hole.
I don't know what Ryan's going to touch on today, but yeah, in those books, it's pretty interesting. It's the Khan. Like, some of it's funny to me, what happens to him during this. It's actually funny to me.
He's currently trapped in, well, not trapped, but he's currently wrapped up in shit in the core worlds during the Istvan 3 stuff. He's not around. I mean, they're doing shit. Him and Dorn are doing shit, but they're doing shit over by Terra.
Oh, I'm sorry, not Khan. Karn.
Oh yeah, Karn. Yeah. Especially as we get closer. Especially as we get into Istvan 5.
Karn or Angron?
Karn. Karn the Betrayer.
As he's fighting and things happen to him, and it's like, really?
Is this Istvan 3 or 5?
5. Karn stuff comes a little bit more into 5.
It's more in 5.
Oh yeah. It's definitely some crazy shit. So last episode we talked about the war on Istvan 3, which was against the Istvonians that had who had fallen essentially to chaos, and then the War Master was dispatched by the Emperor to go and tell them to knock that shit off. And Horus, not yet revealed as a traitor, was like, "Oh yes, Dad, I'll go do it with gusto." And was like, "You naughty boys, I'm going to slaughter all of you." But he really used it as a screen to send all of the loyalist forces he could down to the planet. And then hoping that the Istvonians would kill a lot of them. And then afterward, he would do a bombardment, a virus bombardment, and then an exterminatus on the planet, or an attempted exterminatus. He did do an exterminatus level event on the planet.
Have you guys seen
to try to wipe them all out?
You guys have seen Tropic Thunder, right?
Yes.
Hell yeah.
I just picture Horus just yelling like big ass titties as he's virus bombing the fucking
planet.
That's just the mental image that came in my head right now. Sorry.
The first time it's
I'm sure it was a tragedy.
later on it's the like the vein in the side of the head pulsing and the eyes bugging out as he's like, fire all the guns, because it doesn't go the way that he wanted to. It
went Kylo Ren style, more.
Right.
When he went, oh, the Terran-born loyalists are a lot tougher than I thought.
Well, that's like your favorite scene. More.
It's just like any plan. You know, we talked about this last episode. Your battle plans hardly ever survive the first shot of the war or whatever. Like, that whole idea is really reflected here. And then, of course, like, how much of it is Chaos fucking with Horus and how much of it is just Horus has underestimated his enemies, how much of it is just the survivability of Space Marines. This is the first conflict where Space Marine has fought Space Marine. Every other time, you know, any other time they would have employed virus bombs, any other time they would have done exterminatus or bombardment from orbit, any of these crazy tactics, it would have been against essentially possibly power armored and genetically modified super soldiers, but essentially against like a civilian military army, like a guard army, I guess, an Imperial Guard level army.
The greatest warriors ever created fighting against each other. Because they've already beaten the weaker ones, Marky.
And that's what we're going to get into today. So as we mentioned kind of towards the end of last episode, there were loyalists up in the fleet still. And two of them kind of took some action to put some to mitigate a little bit of the damage that was done. Trevitz stole a gunship and flew to the surface to warn the troops on the ground that the virus bombing was coming. And then Nathaniel Garro, who was wounded and recovering up in the fleet on the Eisenstein, went into action. So we're going to start off with a flight of the Eisenstein. Mark, you want to read us that quote there? You want to give us your best Nathaniel Garro voice?
Yeah, sure, because I know exactly what he sounds like. He sounds like me.
He sounds like you. Does. He sounds like you when I pitch shift you by 100% in the negative.
I'm assuming he's in the like the audible books, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he sounds like me. All right.
Kind of gravelly.
All right.
But with a British accent, some right?
Because they all have British that ain't accents. Happening. That ain't happening. It'll break down too quick.
Twirl your mustache and be like, I do say, my good sir.
Yeah, that ain't happening.
Come on, Marky, let's hear it.
Dude, I don't even have a Mexican accent, let alone any kind of other one. I got like a dummy accent. That's about as good as I get. All right. A flight of the Eisenstein. His dreams and hopes are in ruin. His trust proved false. And his brightest sun fallen to darkness. These are bitter tidings, a nightmare made flesh, but they must reach the Emperor. Nathaniel Garro, former battle captain of the Death Guard, Rugen's tried and true boys.
The during the maelstrom of confusion and destruction that spread across both planet and warfleet above, battle captain Nathaniel Garro knew that word needed to be brought to the Emperor of Horus's treachery. But he also knew that his lightly armored frigate would stand almost no chance against the ships of the fleet. Thankfully, the Eisenstein was close to the rear edge of the fleet's pattern, and further built its distance by informing the fleet's master's office that they were suffering a fusion generator malfunction. Standard naval procedure dictated that they fall back even further in case the worst happened and one of those reactors exploded, which could spread to other ships in the area. However, the Death Guard First Captain Kallus Typhon, who was in command of the Death Guard battleship Terminus Est, knew something was wrong and moved his ship to intercept the smaller frigate. Kallus hadn't heard from his subordinate on the Eisenstein, the usually boisterous commander Ignatius Gruler, who the loyalists had killed during the time that they took the ship. As the Eisenstein raced for the edge of the system, the Terminus Est opened up, forcing the smaller frigate to attempt to evade incoming fire. But the Eisenstein was severely damaged in the exchange, with all of its loyalist astropaths slain and the remaining loyalist navigator mortally wounded. It was left limping closer and closer to the system's edge, unable to communicate and with little chance to navigate the warp to Terra. It was now or never, and Garo ordered a blind warp jump, as much to save everyone on the ship as to get the message to Terra if he could. The Eisenstein slipped free of the closing trader fleet, moving at maximum thrust before making an emergency translation to warp space. And that's really bad. Blind jumping into warp with no navigator and a damaged ship is all sorts of not good.
Yeah, it wasn't just like damage. It was like there's bodies laying exposed to the warp because the Geller field's not covering everything.
Yeah, the Geller field wasn't covering the entire ship. The actual
such a good book.
Flight of the Eisenstein is much longer than we covered as the ship goes through the warp and all sorts of crazy shit happens to them. It is a very good book.
That's the title of the actual book, Flight of the Eisenstein?
Flight of the Eisenstein.
And I have to, so this was after Ishvan 3.
This is during the, so this is after the virus bombing of Ishvan 3, but the events of Ishvan 3 are not over.
Okay.
Like this is the bombs are going off, the lances are going off, and they're trying dipping. To book it. They're trying to book out of there.
Gotcha. Yeah. And this is the Death Guard guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nathaniel Garo is a captain of the Death Guard. So he stole the Eisenstein. He was on the frigate Eisenstein recovering because remember he got his leg ripped off and his like chest crushed and a bunch of other shit. So as he's going through that, he realizes what's going on, organizes the loyalists on the ship. The loyalists fight the traitors on the ship, gain control, and then essentially start slipping, like making excuses to fall further and further behind because they're going to try to warp out. And right before they can do that, Callus Typhon realizes what's going on and turns the Terminus Est towards him. And Typhon is a name that, again, is prevalent in 40. Oh, yeah. And the Terminus Est is prevalent in 40K. Typhon uses the Terminus Est in 40K in the 42nd millennia to deliver the plague of unbelief throughout systems in both the Gothic sector and near Cadia at the end of the Gothic War and right before the fall of Cadia.
And this is the same frigate?
It's the same frigate. Well, you know, it's 10,000 years later and blessed by Nurgle 1,000 times over. But yeah, it's Typhon is still the commander, and the Terminus Est is the same battleship.
Damn, that's crazy.
Meanwhile, back in orbit of Ishvan 3, the Warfleet watched as the firestorm below began to gutter out. The surveyor sweeps and Auspex beams of the Warmaster's forces, eagerly seeking out evidence of the charred and lifeless world. Nearly 100,000 loyalist space marines from across the Sons of Horus, Emperor's Children, Death Guard, and World Eaters legions had taken Coral City while sustaining less than a tenth that number in casualties. So they lost about 10,000 guys out of the 100,000 that landed. Due to the early warning that made it to the planet's surface, of those who had survived the war against the Istvonians, nearly two-thirds had found shelter and survived the virus bombing and firestorm which followed. The bunkers they had taken only hours earlier, bastions within the Preceptor's Palace, and the twisting catacombs of the Siren Hold offering protection. Their training, experience as warriors, and superhuman gifts of the Emperor allowing them to react with the swiftness needed to reseal or repair these safe havens. So we were at about 90,000 who survived the initial battle. Of that 90,000, two-thirds survived the virus bombing and the firestorm. So we're down to
roughly 60,000,
roughly. As the firestorm cleared, communication channels crackled once again into life, frantic signals bouncing across the surface of Ishvan 3 as those surviving space marines began to reestablish battle order, while just as many stabbed skyward, demanding answers, screaming defiance, and spitting curses at their betrayers. For never before in the history had such an act of treachery or malice come between battle brothers as was suffered by the space marines left on Ishvan 3. Just as their messages reached Horus, who flew into a rage at the less than perfect execution of his plans, those left alive on the surface were incised beyond reason, some driven to the point of madness that their own Primarchs had betrayed them.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine it like your own father or mother fucking throwing you to the wolves, essentially, right? For almost no apparent reason at all.
No reason at all, yeah.
We are the Sons of Horus no longer. That name has no meaning to us now. We are the Luna Wolves, soldiers of the Emperor, and for him we will fight, and if need be, we will die gladly.
That was Gravil Loken, captain of the Luna Wolves on Istvan 3.
He wasn't happy.
No.
He wasn't.
I thought they were the Luna Wolves before.
So they were the Luna Wolves up until the battle at Davin. Well, up until the triumph at Olinor. And then between the triumph at Olinor and the battle at Davin, where Horus was wounded, Sanguinius convinced Horus to take the Emperor's suggestion of renaming the Legion in his honor. The Emperor didn't necessarily suggest the specific name Sons of Horus. That had come from inside the Legion. But the Emperor was like, oh yeah, this is a good idea. You should totally do it. And Horus was worried that like it was presumptuous of him to do that. And then after his wounding and after kind of at the time that all of this happened, he decided that Sanguinius had a point and that he should do it. And then like very quickly after he was wounded. So like all of this stuff happened in like the course of 2 years. But yeah, they had not been the Sons of Horus for very long when Loken was like, fuck you, or Luna Wolves again.
Oh, but, gotcha. Okay.
Yep.
But
yep.
As we've talked about in the past, repainting your armor and stuff like that isn't necessarily something that Space Marines like to do. So repainting their armor to be Sons of Horus and then being in a position where they're like, fuck this, I want to go back to my original, you know...
Which the captain called the Halfherd does in the fight in the Eisenstein.
Yeah, there's a couple of others.
I love that character too.
Yeah, there's some really good. The Flight of the Eisenstein has some very interesting characters, and the cool thing about a lot of those guys is they come up later because they end up being
the other
essentially the core of Grey Shields that ends up being like the proto Grey Knights, proto Inquisition, and proto. Yeah. Death Watch, before any of those organizations really exist in total. All of the Space Marine pieces, Malkador starts moving around the Regicide board.
Yep, are all the Marines without a Legion anymore.
No Legion. No Allegiance anymore. So the Red Angel's Wrath.
So good.
As matters began to spiral out of control across Istvan III, Horus attempted to reestablish strategic control of the situation, ordering a second conventional bombardment of the planet. Against the War Master's orders, and perhaps goaded by the angry messages of the loyalist World Eater survivors, or driven to grant the honor of dying by his own hands to those who had once served him, Primarch Angron took matters onto his own. A wave of gunships was followed by a second World Eater's drop pod wave, descending from the mighty flagship Conqueror with Angron and his chosen warriors at the head of these traitor Marines. With a full 50 companies at his back, the Red Angel smashed into the same plaza area west of the Presentor's Palace and unleashed his sons to hunt down their brothers with nothing but fratricide in their hearts. The descending drop pod and strafing Thunderhawks were immediately met with sporadic waves of return fire. On the vengeful spirit, the War Master and his allies could only look on with growing outrage. Angron bellowed as he burst from the belly of his own gunship, smashing to the ground, scattering blackened bones and kicking up piles of ash. His great twin chain axes, Gorefather and Gorechild, screaming into life as if they anticipated the slaughter to come. Withering gunfire tore across the plaza from the surrounding shattered ruins in response to his challenge. But he strode forward, heedless of the impacts. Like some eldritch monster made flesh. Behind him, traitor World Eaters formed into a great arrowhead of pale ceramite and glittering metal. Their butcher's nails, forbidden rage-inducing cybernetic implants, buried deep in their brains, screamed for the slaughter and blood to come. Inevitably, Battle Captain Aralyn, commander of the surviving Loyalist World Eaters, led his own warriors in a charge at the traitors, as the Loyalists were no less rage-filled or driven to slaughter. At roughly 2,000 strong, the Loyalists were driven into a homicidal rage. Truth of the virus bombing, betrayal of their Primarch, and those that they called Battle Brother driving them to cut and then claw down as many of the traitors as they could. Reason and tactics were forgotten, the lines smashing into one another like runaway freight trains. Hundreds were slain in the opening minutes of the melee, with Brother Captain Errol being overwhelmed and dismembered by dozens of traitors, still spitting curses at those he called brother. Dreadnoughts ruptured and exploded in rains of melta-heated shrapnel, destroyed in furious point-blank attacks. In the carnage that ensued, a truth which would become a bitter reality carried through the millennia came to light. When Astartes battled Astartes, all the rigid superhuman discipline, training, conditioning, and experience no longer applied. Matched in armor, weapons, skill, and superhuman ability, and the unshakable resolve to war, an appalling stalemate of grinding and savage attrition was the only result possible. This would become a war that no victor could escape from unscathed.
Well, fuck.
Yeah. Oh, and that's just the beginning.
Big old titties.
Big old titties. It gets worse. So, or better.
Angron only has one chain axe now, right? Because the other one, Karn has, right?
Yes.
No, he has a sword that was destroyed.
Karn?
Oh, Karn has the chain axe,
The reason that Karn has Gorechild and the reason that Angron has Gorefather becomes more...
It's in one of the books.
Yeah, we'll get there. Okay. But right now, he still has both of them.
Yeah, the name rung a bell. I didn't know he had both because I remember looking at Karn's data sheet when I was making my Korn army. And I'm like, Gorechild, that's such a badass like weapon name.
And you got to remember with how he runs his legion. It's like, oh, my weapon's no good anymore. I drop it. I leave it.
Oh,
that comes into play in one of the books.
Yeah. In what came to be known as the slaughter of Coral City's Plaza, 7,000 world eaters crashed together, butchering one another in an undisciplined frenzy of violence. The loyalists had numbered 2,000, facing 5,000 traitors and Angron. And eventually it would be the traitors' superior numbers that turned the tide and decided the battle. Angron was a machine made for killing, careening back and forth like a thunderbolt, rendering armor and sprays of sparks and gouts of blood, shearing and scattering limbs and pulverized bodies in his wake, shrugging off blade strokes and bolter shells as if they were nothing but the bites of insects, continuously calling out challenges, even as he recited the names of the worthy dead his axes reaped. The killing continued until there was nothing left to kill, and the ravaged victors stood amid a field of shattered bodies, their once white and blue armor now a gory red, the filth, blood, and clotted bone ash spreading from them like a stain across the surface of the planet. Angron stood amid his warriors and took in the scene of horror and carnage, exclaiming, "It is well done." He then ordered his world eaters to spread out into the city, hunting down and killing any survivors they found. The first true interlegionary war had begun, marked out with a blood stain on a dead world. For the first time in Imperium's history, its greatest defenders, the Space Marines, turned upon themselves in battle without quarter asked or given. The shocking betrayal, pain, and price of treachery was so great that there could be no respite or relenting given in such a battle, only bitter hatred and bloody vengeance.
So there had to be like some accidental friendly fire, right? Because like they're all wearing the same armor.
Yeah,
you got like you got the guys that are loyal and the guys that are traitors, but they're all wearing the same armor, and then they're all about to just jump in a gangbang, right?
And it gets kind of worse because the Emperor's children start attacking the Preceptor's palace around this time too, mm-hmm. and world eaters, both loyalist and traitor, just attack the Emperor's children because they're there. Like, at a certain point, this big fight between the traitor and loyalist world eaters literally turns into kill the closest thing for a lot of them. For a lot of the loyalists, it doesn't, but for a lot of the traitors, it does. Because not as many of the loyalists had butcher's nails. Mm. Some of them still did. A lot of them still did because a lot of them chose to take them. But they had chosen to take them a lot later in life. Like, they hadn't grown up with them, so they hadn't integrated as enough on one hand. And on the other hand, some of them had just flat out refused. So the loyalists are slightly more in control rabid dogs.
I got you.
2% less rabid dogs or whatever it is.
Like actually listening to the comms links and reacting to yeah, the other loyalists and trying to pull some tactics off.
Yeah.
And like one of the only ones that still does that, at least towards the end of the heresy during the siege of Terra, is Karn. Karn is constantly fighting his own nails. Desire to just murder everything to be tactical in like some way, shape, and form.
Hmm.
The Horus Heresy novels with Karn, it's like really, it's a whole completely different view of him.
Yeah. Because it's basically like his internal war against his desire to just fucking see red and slaughter everything. And the fact that he knows his legion won't survive if he doesn't make tactical decisions. It's like the other, we've talked about this before. This will come up towards the end of the heresy. But like Angron gets to the point where he just starts tearing holes in the side of the Conqueror and jumping out onto planets. So Space Marines and deck crews have to run around behind him fixing the fucking ship so it doesn't depressurize. Like Angron doesn't find a door or a bay. He makes a door and jumps the fuck out. And then he's like, the ship will fix itself or all my guys will die. And like the worst of the World Eaters, especially the longer the heresy goes on, are essentially they'll stop and harvest entire planets. So the Space Marines have something to hunt down and murder while traveling from one planet to another. Because if they run out of things to fight, they start fucking slaughtering each other.
That's like, pretty gnarly.
Like in one of the other novels, I know we'll sidetrack, but the point Ryan's making is there's loyalists that are trying to get on a ship, and his butcher's nails are so pumping, he just has to kill somebody on the way in, just get that little waft of blood.
He's got to take the edge off.
Just a nip.
He got to take that edge off on the way in while they're trying to sneak. Quotes.
Just the tip.
Just the tip.
Spotlight on Karn because he's a cool 100%. Character. I'm very interested in hearing some stuff about him.
Well, I'm really liking, you know, listeners, if you've been listening to us for a while, you've obviously kind of seen the style of our episodes change, and we're getting into kind of like, as we're looking at lore, we're kind of focusing a lot more on battles because so much shit happens in the battles, and you get a lot of like personality from the different characters in the battles, be they Space Marines in this case, or like Eldari when we covered some of the stuff from the Dawn of War games, stuff like that. It's really cool to see where their personalities came from. They're no longer just like a data sheet. Now there's a reason why that data sheet exists. Like you brought up, there's a reason that Gorechild is on Karn's data sheet. That's part of the battle.
And I haven't gotten to read the Horus Heresy stuff in a while, but the ones I have read have been like what you're touching on right now. It's the early parts and the more happens and you're like, wow, if that would have just gone one direction instead, be a whole other universe.
Yeah, like if the virus bombing had killed half of the 100,000 Space Marines on the planet,
would have been way different.
Everything would be different, but it didn't. Like every little factor, every little change, every little what if you want, like kind of tweaks Warhammer one way or the other, tweaks the future of Warhammer one way or the other.
Tweaks the narrative.
Yep. Horus was enraged by Angron's disobedience and further disruption to his carefully laid plans. The Warmaster could continue with a second orbital bombardment, but this would risk turning the World Eaters into new enemies and start an interfleet conflict over the planet, even as the battle happened on the planet. It was also almost assured that Angron would survive such an attack and would become Horus's enemy regardless of how the World Eaters Legion saw it. Plus, the World Eaters had proven that there were survivors in greater numbers on the planet than had been anticipated, and so the Wardmaster had no choice but to back Angron's assault, issuing a general order across the traitor fleet to prepare for an all-out ground attack. Once the decision had been made, Horus turned it to his favor. Rather than committing only elements of a single legion to the assault, he pulled on all of the legion's forces loyal to him, ensuring every element of his command was bloodied in the field against their former battle brothers, sealing the traitors together in a pact of blood, a position where there would be no coming back from. So essentially, like, he realized, oh, if there are people still on the fence they won't be anymore. And they won't be anymore because they will have killed Space Marines. And even if they wanted to double cross me, the Emperor is going to fucking kill them. So yeah, they're stuck.
Essentially, catch-22'd.
Yeah.
Solidifies their
heresy.
Yeah, exactly.
The Emperor's children under Lord Commander Edeladon deployed next onto a scorch-flattened former market and open park a few kilometers south of the Precentor's palace. Edeladon was eager to prove his loyalty in light of the loyalist Saul Tarvit's actions to warn those on the planet before the virus bombing. Landing with all the precision expected of the Legion, Edeladon wasted no time ordering his troops to march on the Precentor's palace, assuming he would find a disorganized force of survivors dug in and needing extermination. World Eaters began to land behind him in support of their Legion's ongoing bloody battle of attrition, while Death Guard and Sons of Horus gunships began to sweep the southern and western reaches of Coral City for any survivors, strafing targets and dropping Seeker squads on isolated Loyalist positions. Within hours, however, it became clear that this wouldn't be an easy cleanup operation. Damn it. Edelon's column found the Precentor's palace expertly defended by the surviving Loyalist Emperor's children he had underestimated, and he was forced to retreat, leaving wrecked vehicles behind him. Even in his retreat, the Loyalists continued to harass Edeladon's force from hastily constructed redoubts and expertly timed ambushes. Again, everything the Emperor's children do is just as precise as possible on each side.
Yep.
And like when you're fighting somebody who's just as precise as you and you were expecting them not to be.
Yep.
You get fucked. The gunships circling the city didn't do much better, their AusPac sweeps turning up little useful information amid the burning wreckage of what was left, while the Loyalist forces could use the same tangled ruins to their advantage, launching missiles and las cannon strikes against the hunting gunships. Worse for the traitors, a Sons of Horus Storm Eagle returning to the strike cruiser Minotaur launched a surprise suicide attack inside the launch bay, boxing its intentions to avenge the blood of Terra before ramming itself into a line of rearming gunships while blazing away with all of its weapons, killing an entire company of Horus's legionnaires and forcing the traitor fleet to once again change their Vox and comm channel codes, which caused more havoc and delays among the fleet. The Loyalists' death toll against the traitors began to rise shockingly and rapidly.
Yep. Yeah. Well, think about it. If most of them are
Star Wars,
most of them are Terran born.
Yeah.
You've got more senior, you know, in theory, more senior vets, officers, everybody on the ground. Now they're fucking pissed off. They know what they're fucking against. Their back's against the wall.
Not to mention just like, what do you call it? Like jungle warfare type situation?
Yeah, where, guerrilla warfare.
Guerrilla warfare, thank you.
Yeah, it's nasty street to street city fight guerrilla warfare. And then of course you get that little Star Wars nod with the Sons of Horus stealing, or with the Luna Wolves stealing a Sons of Horus ship and flying it. Oh, they're older codes, sir, but they still check out.
Yeah, right. I mean it is kind of interesting, and it's like, you know, the Loyalists know they're not leaving the planet.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. They know that, you know, there's a finite number of them, and in theory, the war fleet has four times their number, because they were, well, no, three times their number, because they were a third of all the forces in orbit.
Yeah,
so, and
plus there's all the Imperial normal troops that Horus could eventually be like, yeah, I'm pulling my guys out.
Yeah, and the things we haven't talked about yet that we'll talk about later, the Titans of the Legios that are still on the planet. As night fell, the debris which had been thrown into the upper atmosphere of the planet began to fall, rapidly robbing the dead planet of what heat it still had and creating massive thunderstorms and hurricanes. Winds which whipped still hot embers and ash through the graveyard cannons of the city blocks, while massed volleys of lightning strikes rendered Vox traffic and then AusPac units near to useless. While the first stage of the plan had been a success, the Loyalists being separated from the fleet, the second stage was an unmitigated disaster. All the virus bombing had done was strip the world of its civilian population and left behind a hellish battlefield which was a benefit to the Space Marines that now defended it. Added to that was the overconfidence of the Emperor's children's attack. The uncontrollable horde of world eaters scattered throughout the northern reaches of the city, and the fact that the probing aircraft sweeps had basically done nothing but suffer casualties. The fighting across the ruins of Coral City grew only more vicious, with the outnumbered loyalists driven to resist till the bitter end. The loyalists turning the tangled warrens of the city ruins, the Siren Hold, and even the bulked bastion of the Precentor's Palace into their favor, forcing the traitors to attack in specific areas and in smaller numbers, never being able to bring their full weight to bear. Ambushes and running gun battles throughout the cover of darkness, the loyalists even using the city's sewers to seemingly vanish only to reappear behind their enemies when they were least expected. The battles became a grueling war of attrition, as the forces on the ground between traitor and loyalist were almost evenly matched. Horus couldn't even utilize the Legio Mortis, who was still on the planet, as the storms wrecking the ruined city blinded their sensors and defeated their advantage of range. It would even prove impossible to reinforce the traitor forces on the ground, as the storms persisted for days and then weeks, building a coiling screen which effectively cut the fleet off in orbit. In the wrecked industrial zones of the southern city, loyalist snipers and heavy weapon teams exacted a heavy toll on the traitor columns of Vindicator and Predator tanks. While in the Siren Hold, warriors who had once called themselves Sons of Horus defaced their armor and took on the name of Luna Wolves once again. Captain Garvio Loken, former commander of the 10th Battle Company and member of Horus's own inner circle, the Mournival, rose to the mantle of leadership and coordinated resistance in the eastern and southern sectors of the city, masterminding a mobile defense of hit-and-run attacks and counter-thrusts, which stopped the traitor forces of the Sons of Horus from pulling off their lethal encircling tactic they had become known for. So that encircle them and cut off the head, Loken knew that tactic. Loken had fought with that tactic for 200 fucking years. He was like, no, you don't.
Not gonna
I know
happen.
How to break this. Yeah.
I'm just like, get that shit out of here.
Yeah, try something different. I've seen that before.
Don't bring this shit to my table. Yeah.
Get that corn out of my face.
I mean, too, in the novel, it's really cool, too, because it's like super detail on the crap going on.
That's my problem with the books is sometimes it's like, is monotonous the word?
Yeah.
It's just...
Yeah, like we just talked about how in the southern portion of the city, they were fighting in the industrial wastes and taking out Vindicators and Predators. Yeah. That's like a chapter in one of the books.
Jesus.
It's just them. Yeah. Hey, oh, they took out this tank. They took out this tank. They took out this tank. They took out this. And all the tanks have names. And
yeah. The projectiles pluming smoke as it beams across the sky that's scattered by thundering storms and black gaseous forms of evil. And then the missile finally hits the side of the Vindicator's second cousin's twice removed mother that Garvio Loken married himself. Like, it's just like, holy shit, dude, all of this to say a fucking projectile hit the side of a Vindicator. Yeah.
It is kind of probably important to point out, as we're talking about this stuff and as you're kind of building scenes in your head, the movie trope of tank gets hit by a missile or tank gets hit by a bullet and explodes isn't really how tanks get defeated on the field. A lot of times tanks just get like their tread blown off and they can't move anymore, or their gun barrel pocked and it can't fire anymore, or the crew inside gets killed so the tank doesn't function, so that the tank has no crew to function. Tanks don't explode like cars when you shoot them with one bullet near the gas tank. Although that happens in movies a lot, that's not how tanks get defeated.
Was it like Fury, Tom, where it shows like a tank getting hit and all you just see is like a hole, but like the crew is dead?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, like, I mean, I don't know, man. I played World of Tanks before. There you go, boom.
Yeah, yeah. But my expertise comes from the World of Tanks game.
World of Tanks game, they all go boom.
Fury is pretty good because, I mean, it is and it isn't, because it's like, they kind of made it to,
Hollywood.
Well, they made it to where it's like, oh, that tank just got shot and nothing happened. Oh, it just got shot and nothing happened.
Oh, you know, like, it's, what do they call it? It like got deflected. Well,
it's called plot armor.
And that
it's called
plot armor. And that would happen in battle, I mean, even currently, if you hit a tank, I mean, tank's armor is designed to deflect incoming explosive, like RPGs and explosive rounds.
From other
tanks. You hit a tank in the wrong place, the round is going to explode or just bounce off and not really do any damage.
Not a British tank from World War II.
But like the scene in Saving Private Ryan, where as much as that movie may get groans from certain people, or maybe it's your favorite movie, depending on who you are, that the sequence, the end battle sequence, where they make the sticky bombs specifically to blow the tank treads off the tanks.
Oh, yeah, with the socks. Yeah.
All they're trying to do is turn the tanks into blockades so no more tanks can come. And that was like a tactic against tanks. Just if you can stop a tank from moving, you've kind of won. You just have to be out of its range.
Real fast. Can you imagine or its firing arcs? Yeah. Can you imagine making a sticky bomb with your fucking sock?
Do you know how pissed I'd be for the rest of the day?
Probably longer, but
like my foot feels like ass now. Thanks, guy.
This boot leather's not very soft.
My foot looks like a tanned raisin.
It's just like the guy said. He's like, great, now we have to surrender our socks.
Which I'm sure you could see those tan raisins on your Only Toes.
Only Toes, yeah. Only for $3, $6, or $9, you can join our Patreon.
And if you want to see
nothing
our tanned,
to do with our Only Toes, but
if you want to see our tanned raisins get remoisturized, you can watch as we smash grape jelly in between our toes.
If you're into that kind of thing, private.
It's not grape, okay? It's dolphin.
So earlier today, the dog wanted to play, and I was like, "But I can't play. I've got to work. That's how you get fed." And my partner chimed up from her desk, and she's like, "Unless he starts selling more feet pics," and I'm like, "God damn it! It's spread to the house now. It's spread to my mundane life."
That's when you know life is good. When your wife starts making the same jokes you do.
As I say, she'll let me sell feet pics. The amount of money we spend on mayonnaise is going to go up, but that's for the video.
So fun fact.
That's a business expense.
That got me.
Mayo feet.
Not Miracle Whip, just mayonnaise.
Oh God, no!
We're in the Midwest, so maybe Miracle Whip or a Miracle Whip Cool Whip dip. You just dip in one and then go to the other.
Dude, I don't even need it between toes to gag. It's just thinking about it. Oh, I kind of like tapioca. I don't know about between toes, but I kind of like tapioca.
Dipping your feet in wet snot.
Just like cottage cheese. Anybody driving home right now is just like, fuck you guys, man.
We got lore to talk about. I'm grossing myself out here.
No, that was rough. Nothing like warm mayo on a cold foot.
You're welcome, everyone.
Oh my God. The only thing that would make it better would be Kev's ASMR eating dinner.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Is Mike unmuted?
You having some fucking Alfredo pasta over there, Kev? What's going on?
That's why I mute my mic when I'm doing it.
Kevin's like a pug eating food.
Kevin, that's supposed to go in your mouth, dude.
Are you slapping your gums or slapping something else there, buddy?
You should see him try to drink water when he's drunk.
Oh my God. I kind of want to see that now.
I can only imagine.
Oh my God.
It's like watching from the opposite side of the glass.
It's like watching a dying camel with a mustache.
Like watching someone butt chug a fucking pint.
Oh my God.
The butt chug has less spillage.
Less leakage.
Yeah, dude. It's rough.
I got a trainer. Are you
speaking from
now.
Experience here? Like, hold on. Wait, what happened?
This feels like something that happened at Wasteland, to tell you the truth.
Now, is like, how big is the funnel, right?
No, he got like crossfaded at a party.
Kevin?
Oh, God. Okay, mm-hmm. Okay.
He was like, I don't know why I'm so sick. I'm like, because you just ate like four shrooms without even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he starts, and he's
smart
drunk.
Decisions.
And I came into the bathroom, and he's like sucking off the faucet, And it's like running down his beard, like all the way, like on the floor. And I was like,
"He's good? He's becoming a water hazard in the middle of some dude's house.
he made a tube out of his hands and his lips onto the faucet.
Oh,
like,
my God.
And the noise he made. Like, you know, when a pool vacuum, like, kind of gets up on the edge? No. No, like, you know,
okay.
Like when a pool vacuum kind of gets too close to the water and it's just like, like I thought he was drowning. I was
like, pretty good.
You know, the only thing you have to do to save your life is stop doing everything you're doing right now.
I walked in and I was like, what the fuck are you doing? Well, he's like, I'm so thirsty.
Trying to deep throat this faucet, Tom. Can I get a little privacy?
Dude, that's what it looked like.
Like, almost like walking in on that Liar movie. I'm like, why are you kicking my ass? Do you mind?
I'm like, why are you tongue fucking the faucet?
You know, sometimes when you gotta go, you gotta go.
Practice, man.
So Edeolon's,
speaking of perfection,
right? So Edeolon's Emperor's Children. I cannot pronounce this dude's name. It has too many fucking vowels in it.
Eidolons. Eidolon.
Eidolons?
Eidolon.
Umlaut.
Umlaut.
Edeolons. Edeolons?
Edeolon? You're adding an I in there, unless Ryan's
Edeolons?
No, it's E-I-D-O-L-O-N.
It's like I colon. Like colon, like your ass.
It's Eidolon.
With a D. Yeah,
Eidolon. Eidolon. I've been saying Eidolon, so I'm going to keep doing Eidolon. Eidolon's Emperor's Children continued in vain to take the granite bulk of the Preceptor's Palace, which was held by the impeccable resolve and tactical excellence of Captain Tarvitz and his warriors. The loyalists had even claimed heavy weapons and vehicles, now patch repaired and back in service from Eidolon's first failed attacks. That's why I brought up that fact with tanks. They went out, got the tanks that they disabled, got the heavy weapons they disabled, and pressed them back into the war, but on their side.
Put some bubble gum, duct tape, and beer cans on there. You're good to go.
100%.
So for $369, you can see the picture that Ryan has pulled up, which looks like a world eater fighting a world eater, but his armor is still, unless that's a word bear.
That's an ultramarine.
That's an ultramarine? Oh, so is this Ishvan 5? Or is this just a random picture?
This is just a random picture from the Heresy.
Because that's
we try to bring up pictures related, but sometimes there aren't a lot of pictures related, so sometimes we just find some cool 40K nonsense.
Yeah, because that's that other Terminator. What are they called? I'm not as familiar with 30K.
Tartarus?
Cataphracton.
Cataphracty, yeah.
Tartarus.
I was like, Centurion?
Dude, when Centurions came out, that was like a weird thing.
Centurions are dope.
Centurions are dope.
But like whenever they come up with like a new unit or like a new thing,
it's a little weird.
It's just like, where was this in the lore the entire time? Like, it just randomly came up.
For 10,000 years, we forgot to mention this one thing.
Exactly, right?
The entire time.
Because what do you call them? The STCs or STDs were lost. Yeah.
The STDs were lost.
Just recently found it and able to apply it.
It's the TNT.
He's dynamite.
Among the loyalists fought ancient Rylanor, a dreadnought of the Third Legion, an undying icon of the past glory and honor which the traitors had cast aside. Many times the ancient was thought defeated, only for the venerable dreadnought to roar to life once again, spitting death into the face of the traitors. Edeolon's forces were further blunted by the need to protect their flanks and rear, as world eaters, either loyalists who had survived or maybe blood-crazed traitors who no longer gave a shit, would lunge from the rubble and darkness to harass the line, stealing and plundering supplies. In the northwest, even while dug into the Istvanian bunker network and trench lines, the Death Guard loyalists faced the worst of the battle. From the city side, the World Eaters' traitors raged, hacking their way into the trenches and bunkers, heedless of the amount of casualties they suffered, only to leave all those they encountered a bloody ruin. And out on the plains, having braved the massive hurricanes which raged across the planet, was Mortarion, as impeccable and relentless as death himself. He had landed the great relic assault ship Omen amid the howling gales and lashing lightning, turning the turrets and torpedo tubes of the ship into flattening the closest of the trench lines, blasting a clear path and leaving no room for ambushes by the loyalists. Then, in the defiance of the great hurricane winds, darkness, and lashing rains, the Death Guard marched forth in ordered ranks, accompanied by the Legion's own Bahamas of War, Spartan heavy assault transports, Fell Blades, and Typhon super heavy tanks. With the Reaper Primarch marching at their head, the traitors began a systematic and relentless attack, Mortarion grimly counting the dead. I think it's interesting that they point out both Mortarion and Angron are like naming and counting their own soldiers as they butcher them.
Did you did you see that they're making a new Mortarion like model without wings?
I did not. Oh, maybe they're making a 40K or a 30K one?
Yeah.
They must be. That's dope. I really like the Fulgrim one, by the way.
Oh, that's a Perfiron. That's my baby.
Yep. I think the reason being, like, when you read how those two Primarchs are, like, as batshit crazy as Angron is, he takes things to heart.
Like, it's the whole thing. Everything's honorable, yep. Yeah.
Everything that happens. So, like, basically, he's naming and remembering his sons because, well, now they've fallen in battle fighting him. And Mortarion is, like, just really grim and, like, if I remember right, he was on the cusp about becoming traitor or not.
Yeah, he was one of the ones that signed up first, but he kind of went back and forth a lot. But yeah, and Angron, part of the reason that Angron went to the planet was that he didn't want his sons, even though they were traitors in his heart, to die a dishonorable death. He wanted to bring them the honorable death he thought they deserved. So yep. Even if he thought they were traitors to his cause because they were loyal to the Emperor, he still wanted to grant them the honor of dying on the field. And that goes back to that gladiatorial thing as to where, like, Mortarion kind of felt that he fought for the lives of every one of his sons, even the Terran-born ones, because of the shit that he dealt with. And when we get into the Primarchs in earnest, we'll talk about Angron's background and Mortarion's background and Gilliman's background. We'll get into the planets they came from and the shit that shaped them.
Yeah, the thing that I kind of like that you brought up was the fact that, like, this dreadnought, this venerable dreadnought just kept coming back to life and just murdering people. Or, like, there was world eaters that were, like, buried under rubble that just popped up like daisies and just started murdering again. Like, there's, like, stuff like that is just crazy. It's just metal, right?
Yeah.
Like, hearing shit like that, very, yeah, 40K, like a, very awesome.
Like a rocket would tear like the hallway down and it would bury this venerable dreadnought, and the traitors would swarm over where it was to attack the loyalist position that they were trying to get to. And Rylanor would just stand up and blast the fuck out of their backs because he wasn't actually dead yet. I'm not dead yet.
Still alive.
The way you said that was really funny. Just blast the fuck out of their backs.
Like, blast.
Just blast it on their backs. Like,
he just comes up and he's like, Superman.
Just blast him.
6 kilometers north of the ruins of the Imperial Starport, under the shroud of a storm which swallowed the far reaches of the city, something stirred under the drifts of ash and bone. A great brazen orb slowly grinding and rotating itself out of the blackened earth. The orb was a siege crucible of the Ordo Redactor, and it opened like a huge inverted clockwork flower made of bladed bronze petals. It had been launched from the dying side of the Loyalist Mechanicum Gallus Xerxes 977 and functioned much like a Space Marine drop pod, although it was far larger and far more durable. Regardless if its occupants, had they been merely flesh and blood, even that of an Astartes, would have likely not survived the impact. But its occupants weren't merely flesh and blood, and Magos Redactor Calib Decima and his bodyguard of cyborg Thalax emerged, ready to rain destruction down on the traitors, not from a place of burning hatred and rage, but one of cold logic. It took nearly 2 months for the great storms to clear and wane to a point where the traitors could land reinforcements and supplies in sufficient quantity once again. In that time, the Loyalists had bled the attackers for every city block and kilometer of ground they had taken. Rough estimates putting the Loyalist death toll at 20,000, with the traitors being closer to 35,000. The Loyalists still held the Preceptor's Palace, even though the Emperor's children and World Eaters continued to attempt to take it by storm, while Loken's Luna Wolves held the sectors surrounding the Siren Hold, having turned them into his killing fields. In the northwest, the Loyalist Death Guard had been caught between Hammer and Anvil, the World Eaters at their back and the traitor Death Guard at their face. Those Loyalists who couldn't escape being forced into ever smaller pockets of resistance. However, some of the traitors' heavy siege armor crews still bore loyalty to those their Primarch had now marked as enemies and either refused to fight or turned their guns on the traitor forces during the assault. A five-hour running battle, known to the surviving Death Guard as the Veil of Grief, saw even the legendary resolve and discipline of the 14th Legion break down. Traitor and Loyalists alike became lost in the maelstrom of battle, firing on friend and foe alike. The traitor Death Guard Marshal Durok Rask and his command squad were killed to a man by the Loyalist Mortog Destroyer Squad. Mortarion himself was even said to have suffered a wound, burned by a plasma blast from a Predator tank from his own lines, before he and the Death Shroud hacked it into bloody ribbons. Only through Mortarion's order to withdraw and regroup did the conflict end, although this allowed time for some of the Loyalist Death Guard to escape, before Mortarion once again tightened his grip around those that survived. So again, it's brutal. Like, the Death Guard are not known for battle lust and fighting the closest enemy and turning on, you know, on I guess they're other. All turning on themselves, but like turning on themselves, like in a unit.
In confusion, right? I'm assuming not so much in
blind rage. The Veil of Grief is like, the battle became so heated between the Death Guard and the Death Guard that they just started slaughtering, like World Eaters, they just started slaughtering each other.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of like in The Mummy when the brother was like walking through the crowd, he's just like trying to be one of them.
Emotive.
He's just like, oh shit, like I'm a traitor right now because I'm surrounded by all these motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Like, oh, all the traitors are dying. Let me go join my side again.
That's crazy though. When you read that, it's 2 months.
Yeah,
of
yeah.
this going on.
The hurricanes and lightning storms have the upper hand. Thick. Yeah, yeah.
They have the upper hand on the planet. Like, that's just fucking crazy.
That guerrilla warfare ain't no joke, man.
That's why you know the Imperium's the greatest. But yeah, anyway.
We estimated that 60,000 Loyalists were alive on the planet, and we know that the fleet dispatched the same number. So there's 60,000 Loyalists and 60,000 traitors on the planet. By the end of that 2 months where the fleet can't land any supplies, the Loyalist numbers are down to 40,000, but the traitors on the planet are down to 25,000. And like, just the sheer number of Space Marines that have died in this conflict in 2 months on a useless planet. Like,
yep.
There is no reason to fight for this rock anymore. This is 100% a bout of honor. There's no tactical reason to fight over Istvan III. It is dead.
Well, I wouldn't say they're fighting over it. I would say it's more of just an extermination, right? They're trying to wash their hands of...
Fighting on it.
Yeah, yeah. It just happens to be the battle, yeah.
Right.
As the storms faded, fresh companies of traitor legionaries, tanks and heavy armor landed on the outskirts of Coral City.
Outskirts.
Did I say outskirts?
No, Mark did.
No, I did. Oh, I was joking around early and I started reading the notes. I was like, I'm going to continue the notes. And I was like, yeah, on the outskirts. Whoops.
The Loyalist Death Guard Enclave was the first to suffer as Mortarion poured his legion's strength into the area. What armor, mostly Malkador heavy tanks, the Loyalists had captured, put up a short-lived defense in the face of the massed fell blades and long-distance guns of Legio Mortis. With the field under his complete command and the Loyalists surrounded, Mortarion sent in his forces. The Death Guard tactical squads packed shoulder to shoulder as they marched into the defenses. The Loyalists put up a defense until the end, their artillery falling silent first, and then their bolters and Melta barrels glowing red hot and cracking from overuse. But the traitors were relentless and overcame every barricade, redoubt, and trench line. Those few Loyalist death card that could escape did so into the deepest reaches of the trench lines and bunkers, collapsing tunnels behind themselves, but Mortarion came for them anyway, hunting them down in the darkness with vortex charges and siege drills. The Warmaster unleashed his wrath on the remains of Coral City, and the Sons of Horus task force, 30 companies strong, led by Ezekiel Abaddon and his elite Justiarian Terminators, landed in the city's southwest with heavy armored support. They started to lay waste to the city block by block, leveling everything and flushing out Loyalists as they were encountered. With the attack fully underway, mass conveyors started to land behind the traitors' lines, bringing fresh Titans from Legio Mortis and Legio Aedox to reinforce the Titans that had weathered the virus bombing and apocalyptic storms. So the entire time, the entire 2 months, the Titans of Legio Mortis that are standing on that field are just fully locked down. No one gets in, no one gets out, no one can communicate with them or damage them. They're just sitting there for 2 fucking months.
Can you imagine having to take a shit? You're just like, dude, I really got a shit.
You just shit in the Titan. They've got toilets.
You're floating in.
What are you talking about?
What about a fart right out of you?
No, but what about the guy that still has his asshole, right?
Yeah, yeah. There's like three pilots. It's like an airplane bathroom, right? You like shit and piss in the bathroom, and then like every 3 weeks, one of the servitors just voids the bowels of the Titan, and it just all this shit. Can you imagine piss the Titan?
Can you imagine like fucking dumping like what is that? Blackwater? Is it Blackwater?
Yeah, Blackwater. Because you can't read gray water.
You just shoot Blackwater out of the back of your
out
warhound.
Of the back of a Titan.
Some dude's just walking by. There's some loyalist just walking by, and he's just like, "Oh, what the fuck?"
I imagine
this is why they turned traitor.
I imagine it's different for every Titan. So, like the ones that are human shaped, like they evacuate, you know, straight between their legs. The Warhounds, they have to like go up to a building and like pick one leg up. Like they're pissing on a fire hydrant and shoot it sideways.
You imagine like a Vindicator's just chilling right there and he's like, I can't move. And just sees the Warhounds raise his leg.
I just have to deal with it.
He's just like, for the Emperor, as he gets fucking shat on. It's 2 month old fucking
by a Titan
princep shit. And he's just like, oh god,
really?
I gotta wait for that shot.
This is how they created those Nurgle Titans.
This is my war paint.
That's it right there.
My war paint.
In the shadow of these. It'd be a great war story you share with the other Vindicators, right? Dude, this,
oh my god, dude.
You can't top that, right? You're like, oh, I had the best shot ever, right? I shot this fucking guy from one frigate to another. He's like, yeah, but have you ever been shit on by a Warhound Titan?
By a Warhound Titan and not moved?
That's discipline.
A motherfucking Titan shit on me.
In the shadow.
He's all into it. He's like...
He's like moaning.
He's like, lucky dog.
I like pain.
In the shadow of these colossal bulk landers, a ragtag assortment of other craft began to land. Black insectile gunships and battered civilian lighters, their hulls decorated with human bodies and blood. From the black craft came the heretics of the Dark Mechanicus, and their strange weapons, robotic spider skulls, and multi-headed battle automaton that dwarfed even dreadnoughts. But it was from the other craft that the true horror descended, enough to stagger even the Astartes warriors, the witch priests of Davin's Serpent Lodge, scarecrow figures draped in sickening taint of warp, which coiled about them like unseen, worm-ridden shrouds. Even though the Loyalists had held out for so long, and even in some cases started to turn the tide during the storm, that comparable respite was over. The traitors now vastly outnumbered and outgunned the Loyalists, for each Loyalist killed in the conflict could never be replaced. The cruel math of slaughter had swung back in the Warmaster's favor.
I thought you said that they were covered in taints, and I was like, "Oh yeah. Shit!
Oh,
warp taints."
I was like, "Damn, these guys are hardcore, man! Just fucking give me your taint, just add it to my collection."
I am the Gooch Commander.
So Davanites are a little taller than regular humans, but they're not quite as tall as an Astartes. And these Davanites are like skin and bone. So they're simian looking humans. They look more like apes than people in a lot of ways. They kind of look like, to me, their art, they look a little orcish. But these guys are like deathly thin.
Planet of the Apes type shit, or?
Yeah, a little bit. That's kind of how the Davanites look. Like the Charleston Heston Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
They were just really thin and really gaunt, but they're such powerful, like, warp witches that as they walk by Astartes, the Astartes warriors, like, flinch back and shrink from them. Like, that's how gross and, like, tainted and, like, warp powerful these things are.
Dude, can you imagine you're a super soldier, like, bred for battle, and you see, like, this skinny, wretched little thing covered in taints, like, walking next to you, and you're just like, ugh. This is cringe a little bit. Yeah.
That's why I was giving more context from your taints.
So I was bred for war. I fight for the Emperor.
You got this fucking thing. This little walking next to you. You're just like, oh my God.
That gives me the willies.
I was bred for war, but that thing gives me nightmares.
I don't like it.
I can tell that thing can take a beating and I can't.
That thing's icky. Dude,
it's like every once in a while you meet that really big, strong, like alpha-ish guy, and then like a worm or like anything slimy gets introduced and they freak out.
Yeah. So the icky word comes from my daughter. The first time I showed her E.T., she was, I think she was 5. And we're all excited because she's like into like just weird movies and stuff. And we set her up and turned it on. And the first time she saw E.T., she like kind of gasped, kind of like this tank covered guy, and just kind of like pulled her head back. And she's just like, ugh, I don't like it. It's icky. We're just like, aw, damn. So yeah, I imagine it's kind of like that, you know? That space was just kind of like, ugh, that's icky.
Things are naturally moist.
There's going to be an episode, and I'm going to be like, in foreshadowing the battle. And Marky is going to be like, foreskinning the battle? And there's going to be like an hour conversation about foreskin.
That's usually how the podcast works. I'm surprised you're surprised by it.
The Space Marine's just walking, and then he's like, oh. Wait.
It's just a goat screaming. All right, Mark. All right, Mark, you got the quote?
Our names may be forgotten, and our bones crumble to dust, but our deaths will echo through the millennia to come.
Captain Saul Tarvitz, words spoken in the hours before the fall of Coral City enclaves.
Bloodied but unbowed, the Loyalists prepared to meet their deaths as this last mass assault of traitors marked their end. The traitors moved through the city, relying on overwhelming force to overcome the pockets of resistance they found along the way. Their goal, the stronghold of the Loyalist enclaves, the Presentor's Palace. Before their advance, Avenger Strike Fighters and Thunderheart gunships strafed and assaulted strategic targets, with high explosives and cannon fire, attempting to pin the Loyalists into cover, preventing any scattering or withdrawing tactics. Thousands of the Warmaster Space Marines, Sons of Horus, Death Guard, and World Eaters moved from the landing grounds outside the city in a vast crescent pattern, supported by hundreds of rhinos, land raiders, and predator tanks, with jet bikes, sky hunters, and land speeders screaming through the air protecting the flanks, hunting down those missed and ever wary for ambushes. Behind them came the titans of Legio Mortis and Legio Audax, two battle mana pools of Warlord and Reaver Battle Titans, supported by dozens of Warhounds, all under the command of Dice Ira, an Imperator-class Titan which loomed head and shoulders over the tallest of the rest, each of its footfalls cracking the tortured and wasted cityscape like ice as it loomed over even the tallest of the ruins, likely points of resistance withering under the blistering fire of the Titan's weapons, fired even as the column continued to advance. And of course, the Titans out, they start out kind of behind, but they end up in front of the crescent as they advance because they move faster than the Space Marine troops. They get there first.
Yeah, I'm sure it's not the ideal vacation, you know?
come to Istvan 3.
Yeah.
The jewel of the Imperium.
Dude, can you imagine like the hellscape that you had to live in? No food. Or like all the food, because like everything just got virus bombed, right?
Yeah.
So you can't imagine the food in the bunkers is too great.
Yeah, they're surviving on what survived in the bunkers, and then like what Space Marines can do, like eat dirt and rocks and weird shit.
They were probably at some point eating dead traitors.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, you do what you have to.
Meat's meat, right?
What's some of that. What's for dinner? Gooch liver.
I'm sure some of that Warhound Blackwater was looking real scrumptious after a while.
I mean, if you think about it, Space Marine's metabolism can handle it. It's just protein. You like a protein shake.
I do want this shirt. Visit Istvan 3. Fresh air, fun, and views to die for.
That's pretty good. Yeah, I can't imagine it looked too pretty, dude. With all the storms, the virus bombing, the firestorms, the normal storms after the firestorms. Like, just the whole ecosystem of the planet gone to shit. It's just a hellscape at that point.
It's a planet going towards, like, a Mad Max world, would be my guess. And it's a dead planet at this point. But, like, it's on that transition. But at this point, it's not pretty golden sand. It's like piles of blackened ash and charred bone.
Yeah.
Like, and that's probably what they're eating. You know, when they can't get rations, they're probably first cracking open the bones and eating the marrow. And then, you know, as Chuck said, eating the dead, either they're dead or the dead that they've killed.
At least it's
cooked. You know? Yeah. And at the worst of times, eating rocks and dirt, because Space Marines can subsist on anything.
They crack open those bones like a fucking king crab leg, dude. Just fucking suck out the marrow.
Or just eat the entire bone, really. I mean, at the end of the day.
If you're picky, you know, like those kids that like to scrape off the black stuff on toast. Like, I'm sure there's some Space Marines that were like, dude.
I don't think Space Marines need their sandwiches cut diagonally with no crust.
You never know, man.
I'm guessing.
Well, that's yucky.
Making me stand next to these weird sorcerers and you don't cut my peanut butter and jelly diagonally, I'm beginning to see why these loyalists don't like you.
Can you imagine like the conversation though? He's like, brother's house, why do you keep scraping the char off the bones? He's just like, it's icky.
It's yucky.
It tastes better, brother.
I do not eat such filth.
I have a more sort of refined palate. He's scraping it off with his power armored pinky extended.
I have a sensitive composition.
Oh my god.
Oh god damn.
As they approach the high sided curtain wall of the Presentor's palace, the Titan Legion were met by the traitor Emperor's children forces that still laid siege to the vast compound. The princeps of the Legio Mortis had clear orders, however, and cared nothing for which forces, traitor or loyal, lay before him. A single deafening blast of their war sirens was the only warning gave to Idolon's command before the Titans opened fire. The governmental compound had been made by the Imperium's engineers to resist and outlast planetary invasion or revolution, and had weathered the rebellious weapons, then the Astartes weapons, then the heavier weapons of armor, virus bombings and firestorms, and finally the massive hurricanes which had lashed the dead city. But they would not withstand the volcano cannons and turbo laser destructors of the Titans. Around them, the Space Marine legionaries could do nothing but weather the storm of that fear-filled display of weaponry. When the barrage ceased, the black smoke cleared and the flurries of powdered dust drifted away. The destruction of these weapons was revealed. The curtain wall was gone, only a jagged tumble of debris marking where it had once stood. The great dome of the palace was crumbled, and the grounds around it lay shattered and scattered like children's blocks. The Titans howled once again, this time in triumph, and then they were answered by Angron and his world eaters, who swarmed from around their feet and into the tangle of the ruined palace. During the long drawn out war and siege, Lucius had come to resent his friend Captain Tarvit's role of success in the defense, and then the respect that the captain had commanded from the other loyalist Astartes. Lucius had contacted Edeladon and promised he would deliver Tarvitz, breaking the loyalist's defense, in exchange for the War Master and Third Legion accepting him back into their ranks in good graces. Edeladon accepted, and Lucius betrayed and slaughtered 30 Astartes who were defending one of the ways that the traitor's assault had opened up. Lucius had partially succeeded by convincing the loyalist Captain Solomon Dementor in the second company of the Emperor's Children that they were actually attacking a group of traitors. So Lucius succeeded in this not on his own. He had help, but he had help by lying to a guy. A deceit Solomon learned of all but too late. Lucius killing the wounded Dementor, and with his place restored among the ranks of the traitors, Lucius then challenged Tarvitz to a one-on-one duel, wishing to prove once and for all who the better swordsman was. Tarvitz actually was the victor in that duel, and a wounded Lucius had to flee to rejoin the traitors' lines. However, since Lucius had opened up this hole by destroying this, like, great hall that these Marines were protecting, because it doesn't take many Marines to hold a fortified position. And the fact that Lucius was able to cut them all down from behind essentially bought his way back into the graces of the traitors.
Can you imagine the Space Marines inside the fortress as, like, the Titan Legions are rolling up and they're like, don't worry, man, this thing is robust. And it's just fucking Titan Legions just fucking blow it away.
I'm sure they knew. They probably, as soon as the Titans started marching into the city, I bet you they all would have moved back as deep into the palace as possible. I take that back. I do remember some of the palace, and that's pretty much what happened. They pulled back as far as they could because they knew that the walls were not going to hold against the Titans. The fact that the Titans hadn't spoken yet was one of those things that all of the loyalists were kind of afraid of, because that's the end. That's the end game. There's nothing coming back. You know, like, 30 Marines, even in a fortified position, aren't going to outlast a volcano cannon barrage. It's just not going to happen.
That's weird, because, like, I know the fortress went through a lot before the Titans got there, but you would think that they would make it Titan-proof. Because, like, Titans aren't...
good. They made him they made him Eldar proof. They made them Orc proof. They made them Chaos Cultist proof. At this point, there was nothing in the Imperial engineering that said Titans are going to turn against the Imperium. There was no reason for them to think that big.
I got you.
If the Titans protecting your governmental palace have fallen to Eldari, Wraith Lords, the least of your concerns is whether or not the Imperial Palace in the middle of the city is going to survive. Yeah, like, they didn't really think, or they didn't really put that much into it. Or it could just be, at this point, 7 bad things have happened to the palace. Is it going to survive the 8th? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Last stand of the Luna Wolves. While the main traitor column stormed the palace, further assaults were taking place to break the back of the loyalist resistance in the northern and southern sectors. Ezekiel Abaddon led his Sons of Horus forces against their former battle brothers, Captain Loken and his Luna Wolves. Abaddon was under explicit instructions: return victorious or do not return at all. And so Abaddon assaulted the Siren Hold from all directions at once, attacking from land and air. Castius assault ramps smashed into the upper tomb spires, while jump pack equipped assault squads descended from open troop bays onto targets known to be sniper roosts of the Luna Wolves. The ruins trembled as ground level Spartan and Land Raider heavy tanks smashed paths through the rubble, led by the midnight black and tarnished bronze of the first company Justicarian elites. They fired into the cemeteries and shrines alike, toppling all in their path as return fire stitched along their hulls. Despoiler squads eagerly raced forward, eager for blood, their chainswords revving as they moved towards the defenders' positions. The Luna Wolves fought valiantly against the hated traitor brothers, but they were outnumbered and outgunned, and their ammo reserves were all but spent. Some fought free or even escaped, as that was a great victory against such odds. Others held for as long as they could under the onslaught of the Justicarian bolt shells and plasma and power fists, firing until their guns ran dry and then fighting until they were hacked to bits. The Siren Hold fell in an hour, but still hundreds had fled, enraging Abaddon, who spit curses and insults to those under his command who he saw as having moved too slow, before ordering his troops to search the city, while he accompanied the Dark Mechanicum in hunting those who had fled below. Davenite witches and cultists hunted among the city's rubble, as Phosphex canisters were dumped into the sewers and air vents of the catacombs. During this manhunt, Abaddon and Horus Axamund confronted Captain Loken and Tarkin Torgadon. Is that how you pronounce that, Chuck? Torgadon?
Sure.
You don't remember.
Torgandon.
Captain Loken and Tarik Torgandon in the ruins of the city. In the battle which followed, Little Horus killed Tarik. Horus Axamund was also known as Little Horus. There was a Little Horus and a Big Horus. Little Horus killed Tarik, and although he fought valiantly, Loken was critically wounded by Abaddon. Abaddon leaving Loken alone and bleeding in the ruins of Coral City to be consumed in the final oncoming orbital bombardment. As the darkness of night once again claimed the graveyard city, the only lights came from stabbing searches which swept the ruins for any survivors. The only sound, the grinding steps of the Titans or the sporadic gunfire as some traitor found loyalist. Istvan III was once again truly a dead world. The battle was over and now could be called little more than a manhunt. Traitor forces hunting the most dangerous prey, other Astartes, to their extinction. And I think it's fucked up, but also ends up working in his favor that Abaddon basically fucking mortally wounds Loken and then just leaves him. He's like, you're going to die. You're going to die by bombs. I'm not going to honor you with a death you deserve. I'm going to fucking leave you to die like the peasants.
The disrespect.
Which totally works out in his favor.
the disrespect.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Well, and Abaddon, so there's a group that we haven't talked about yet, or we haven't talked about in detail yet, called the Mournaval. And the Mournaval was made up of four soldiers. It was Abaddon, Horus Axamund, Loken, and Tarik Torgadon. Those were the four members of the Mournaval, and they were the like inner circle, the inner circle that advised Horus in means of battle. And Loken and Tarik didn't go traitor. They stayed loyalist, as to where Abaddon and Horus went traitor. Not only that, but Abaddon and Loken had already started to have like kind of a weird, bitter rivalry. So yeah, it was 100% one of those things where Abaddon was like, you're not worthy of being my brother. You're not worthy of being an Astartes, and you don't deserve an Astartes death. So he wounded him to the point where like Loken could have survived what was most likely going to die. Like he couldn't escape or save himself. And then was like, I'm just going to leave you for the bombs. like, sorry, fuck you, and walked off, which again totally works in Abaddon's favor, because Loken 100% dies in this battle and is not involved ever again.
Yep.
That's unfortunate.
That's sarcastic foreshadowing, Marky.
Yeah, good old Abaddon. He can never finish anything.
Excuse me. That's my other boy. You watch it. I mean, it's really weird that like my two favorite characters are Loken and Abaddon. I don't know what that says about me.
I don't know. Cadia seems pretty finished.
Cadia seems quite fucked, I'd say.
Well, I mean,
it's the long war, Chuck. It's called the long war for a reason.
Took him 10,000 years to do it.
Hey man, slow and purposeful.
That's right. Time waits for no mere mortal, or even for Primarchs. And though the loyalist resistance on Istvan III had been crushed, the last remnants refused complete destruction. The lingering loyalists on the planet had no chance of escaping, and that was also something Horus could ill afford. Horus couldn't let any of these guys survive at this point. That enough damage with the Eisenstein had happened, and he couldn't let anybody else. Because, like, a couple of hundred Space Marines, you could be like, yeah, boss, they're lying. A couple of thousand with proof? Even harder. At last, Fulgrim joined the Warmaster's fleet in the Istvan system, but he bore unsettling news. Time was no longer on Horus's side. New plans would need to be enacted with haste if they wished to keep news from the Emperor. The time to plan and gather allies was over, and the time to act was now. And with bitter bile on the back of his tongue, Horus ordered the withdrawal from Istvan III, leaving it a cemetery of his deeds in his wake. Fulgrim and Mortarion had to physically drag Angron back from the surface of the world. He didn't want to leave. He had to be subdued and dragged. As his fleet departed, Horus ordered the guns of the Vengeful Spirit to once again bombard Coral City. Not with virus bombs, but with conventional weaponry. These batteries pounded the city flat and broke the tectonic plates of the world, sending them into further convulsions which shattered the landscape. Across Istvan III, ever-shrinking rings of defiance still existed. The loyalists and traitors stuck on the planet, fighting it out to the bitter end. But the loyalists knew they died exacting a heavy blood price from the traitors who had betrayed them. Kalth, Cygnus, and Prospero also already burned in the flames of this new contagious war, and the massacre was only spreading. However, for Horus, the next goal in his campaign to become the new master of mankind lay not on Terra or in some other distant system, but on a closer world. His sights were locked on Istvan V and the bloody harvest he would enact there.
Bum, bum, bum.
So even as the planet is being fucking bombarded and dying again, there are still traitors and loyalists fighting on the surface. Probably mostly world eaters, but they're still there.
So.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing. Think about it. Angron's on the planet for 2 months.
Yep. Fighting Angron and Mortarion. Although Mortarion's war is a little different because he's very much like, he's in the front, but he's not in the thick of it. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's amazing. Like, think about it. There's Angron for 2 months, wing laced to everything he can see for 2 months. He couldn't kill all the loyalists.
It's a big planet, man.
Say, don't be a traitor.
Well, that's where we'll wrap it up for our third episode on the Horus Heresy, picking up next week with the build up to Istvan V itself. As we mentioned, even in this, not everyone is dead. Loken for sure continues to be a part of the story. Don't worry, he's not gone.
He does. And
even though, he makes it off the planet somehow, Chuck. And even though the traitors once again seem to be relatively in a good position, you know, we've already got Fulgrim and Mortarion having to drag Angron off the planet. Angron pissing Horus off. And this is the first four, and they're already fighting. Like, and of course, like, they're not like coming to physical blows with each other, but they're already arguing on the best ways to do it. They're already, you know, Angron's not listening. Fulgrim is having to talk everybody down. Mortarion is going off and being sullen in his own corner. Like, no one is working 100% together, which, as we covered in both the Battle of Istvaan III and then the war that happened after, every single time the traitors kind of turn on each other and nitpick, it gives the loyalists that little bit of an edge here and there. And that'll continue. You know, there's a reason in 40K that the Chaos Space Marines don't control the galaxy. I hope I didn't spoil it for you, Marky.
They don't?
No. Is Horus still War Master?
As one fucking guy raises from the rubble after Istvaan 3.
Right. Looking for ways to get into contact with us about any of our past episodes, reach us through email at either underthehiveofmadness@gmail.com or jimdarkgaming@gmail.com.
Join our community on Discord. Not only there do we talk about the lore, hobby, tactics of Warhammer 40K, but you can also get involved in other topics like Age of Sigmar, Magic, other RPGs, video games, and much more. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram. Ryan is on TikTok. Or you can check us out at www.underthehiveofmadness.com. Spelling and links should be in the show notes.
Help the podcast grow by liking and reviewing us wherever you get your podcast fix. Our home is Spotify, but you can also find us on Apple, Google, Audible, and many more. Support us on Patreon, www.patreon.com/underthehiveofmadness. All Patreon members get access to video podcasts with minimal editing, so you can see our beautiful faces and hear all of our amazing blunders. All Patreon levels also get access to our quarterly painting contest. Plus, we have perks at higher levels, such as giveaways. So go on over and check that out.
Rock and roll.
Bulges, Sump Rack City, your number one source for skin-tight synth leather pants, Grox hide frilled vests, bolter stud belts, and all the upper hiver attitude you can stuff into your pockets. Check out the new merch from Zygonia's latest release. Clothes made to piss your paw off and make your ma faint. Bringing you Twin Fists of Rebellion, we are the truth peddlers of the pirate Voxwave 665.66 UHMR Chemrat Radio, reminding all of you Chemrats, Hive Mice, and Sump Ghoulies to keep those dials fixed. Right here, same ratty frequency for a dose of the same ratty-ass attitude.
In the hoar-frost-choked shadows of Innsmouth Hive, eldritch beast stirs, their four razored clawed arms and six red eyes, a blasphemous riddle of existence whispered only in the cursed tongues of the abyss, where the very air tastes of madness and despair.
It's spooky, man. You trying to scare us all to sleep, motherfucker?
You got something in my throat.
Dick.
Dick.
That's for later.
Strawberry.